Yeah, what did you think of Jared Abbott on the Ezra Klein show?
I was very happy that he was on there.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I was surprised that they called him and they were interested in the question. Obviously, the New York Times has been pretty reticent to come to grips with the failures of institutional liberalism. And our project with the Center for Working Class Politics is basically taking institutional liberalism to task on its failure with working class voters. But, you know, we have at this point so much data and so much information showing that the trend of working class voters leaving the Democratic Party is more than just a moral crisis. It's a political crisis for the center left and the left more broadly. So I was happy that somebody who is kind of the one of the gatekeepers of intellectual liberalism was willing to even entertain somebody like Jared going on and talking about some of the things he was talking about and basically taking the Democrats to task for this failure, you know?
Jared Abbott was talking about the Democratic penalty.
Right. So we put together a survey of Rust Belt voters, all these Rust Belt voters in the Midwest. And what we were looking at was, what are their attitudes toward the Democratic Party, mainly working class voters, right? And this is one of the things that we do that not a lot of polling outfits do or survey outfits do, which is we focus on working class voters.
You're telling me that the billionaire-funded think tanks are not interested to poll working
Believe it or
class
not,
people?
no, they're not.
Huh, it seems like a big blind spot.
Right. So we put our emphasis all on working class voters. So we oversample working class voters. We're interested in getting all types of working class voters. And not just the simple sort of non-college educated thing, but also getting enough manual workers, getting enough service workers, sort of breaking down the industries. And what we found was that even when working class voters like center-left and left-wing policies, progressive policies, they really do not like the Democratic Party. And the penalty that we discovered was if you put two candidates, the way this survey was designed, was we put two candidates together and the one that wasn't a Democrat, that was listed as an independent, on the exact same platform with the exact same biographical details, you know, did so much better than the Democrat. And
what's the point differential
I think
roughly?
it came out to like 2.9% across the board and then jumped even more the more working class you went down the don't quote me on that though. I have to look at the actual statistics to make sure, but it's substantial. It's not just enough to swing a national election, but it's enough to swing Congress and the Senate. Like it's a really significant jump. And so our conclusion from that was the Democratic Party brand is completely toxic among working class people. It's not just, oh, the policies, oh, the policies, oh, the policies. It's people associate the Democratic Party with a particular type of elite liberalism that looks down on them, that thinks that their moral and cultural values are deplorable, to use Clinton's term. And they don't care that much that the Democrats say they're going to do this, this, and this for you because they look at the party and they think, I don't believe that. So you have the exact same candidate saying the exact same thing. And the real world example of this is, of course, Dan Osborne out of Nebraska, who did basically this. You know, he's an independent. He is an independent. He wasn't a Democrat. And he ran in a deep red district and nearly took out his Senate opponent. Now he's running again. He's pulling ahead of his Republican opponent. So he's a perfect real-world example of the fact that working class people don't necessarily think that the progressive policies are bad. They just don't believe it coming from the Democratic Party.
I mean, the rhetoric from the Democratic Party has, basically had this toxic effect onto voters where people are able to, I think, accurately in most cases, discern the professional class interest behind that rhetoric. And so it's, basically this runaway problem. So in this example of Nebraska, is there a kind of policy prescription in here that, like, running as an independent populist, is that maybe the solution that this
Yeah,
study
so
points to?
our perspective is we think populism is the way, right? We think the local conditions really determine how you're going to run. If you're in a deep blue area, you're going to run as a Democrat, right? It doesn't make sense for you to eschew what most people understand as the main party in their cities or towns.
But if you're in that, let's say, few point differential where like the Democratic penalty could be the thing that actually holds you back from victory in the election, it's a real
And it
consideration.
makes sense to run as an independent. And it makes sense to do it intelligently, right? You have to think about who are the Democrats that they are running? Can I beat them? And who is the Republican that's running and can I beat them? And in Osborne's case and a few other cases, these people were so savvy at showing the Democratic Party basically stand down because you're going to get walloped and let us run the campaigns we want to run. And we'll see if Osborne is successful in that, but I think it's a model for deep red areas where, you know, being a Democrat is just not going to work, you know?
Right, right. I'm not sure if you studied this in the Center for Working Class Politics, but when does this Democratic penalty start?
So we haven't done a longitudinal study, but my back of the napkin math would be it starts around the 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is both the effects of NAFTA.
I was going to ask, yeah.
And the admission of China into the World Trade Organization.
Mm-hmm.
This created, you know, what is now known as the China shock.
Mm-hmm.
Millions and millions of factory jobs flowing out of the United States.
Yeah.
Devastating small and rural communities all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at the time, people forget this, but at the time, Clinton was the NAFTA champion.
Yeah, millions. I think it's we lost 7 million middle-class jobs since Clinton.
Right.
Yeah.
And we got 700 billionaires in response. So hopefully we can eat that.
Is that meme, what I get, what you get? Okay. Great. Yeah. Wonderful trade.
But yeah, so Clinton, you know, running against Ross Perot in particular, the Democrats thought they were very, very clever because Ross Perot was railing against NAFTA, the giant sucking sound of manufacturing jobs leaving the United States. And actually, the president of the UAW, Sean Fain, he was a Perot voter because this was the thing that was animating a lot of working class people, especially in the middle of the country. They were seeing what NAFTA would do, and they knew what NAFTA would do. Well, the Democrats thought they were too clever by half, and they were like, well, we need to embrace free trade. We should embrace economic growth. We should embrace the dynamism of the global economy.
Okay.
Let's go full bore into the NAFTA.
The growth part sounds good.
Yeah, right. And the result was, yeah, we did get growth, but who got all the gains?
Right.
It went straight to the top.
Yeah.
And as a result, all of these factory jobs flow out of the United States, devastating these communities. And we now have, there's a new paper that just came out from the National Bureau of Economic Research that shows the mortality effects of NAFTA were profound.
Yeah.
In areas where manufacturing left, the death rates went through the roof, deaths of despair directly related to the collapse of manufacturing. It's not just that you lost middle wage jobs, you also devastated rural and small town communities, places where a factory wasn't just the place you went to work, but it also supported an entire ecosystem of churches, schools, service sector work. All of that was related to the fact that you had this large institutional hub of economic prosperity, you know?
There's even some research around this that for every, I'm not going to remember the numbers off the top of my head, but for every factory job that you lose 2 to 3 other jobs in that area that were sustained by that middle-class income.
One of the big myths of the knowledge economy, I think, is you transfer out of industrial work and into services, right?
Yeah.
And the services jobs are going to be sort of nicer, better, cleaner jobs. They're not going to be as dangerous. And this is just the natural growth of an economy. You just have to go from industrial to services.
Yeah.
The reason that that doesn't work is that most service sector work depends on a decent industrial base. And just like you said, when you lose manufacturing jobs, you don't just lose manufacturing jobs. You lose all the jobs that are attached to it, right? So if you think about a small town that had, say, a metal manufacturing plant or something like that, the little diner that's nearby disappears, right? The doctor's offices that depend on all those working class voters, the small family practices, they disappear. All the professional services disappear. All the mechanics disappear. All the logistics disappears. Once you repeat that for 7 million jobs across the country, you can see how quickly this spreads. And the result is not only do the gains go up to the top, but they go out to the knowledge hubs, right? So what are the dynamic cities left?
San Francisco, New York.
San Francisco, New York. There are a few others, but they're not nearly as big as those two.
Right.
And you see in the same way that the social world has sort of deteriorated from the middle out, you see the wealth gathering into the coasts.
Yeah.
So the way the Republicans talk about coastal elites actually resonates with a lot of working class people because they've watched the hollowing out of the core and the moving of money
to
the coast.
When they say a true thing, it resonates?
Yeah, believe it or not, right? Yeah.
I picked up this phrase from you. What is a K-shaped economy?
Okay, so it means that people with assets have continued to rise, right?
Yeah.
If you own stock, if you own a decent house, if you live in a fairly nice area where you can have those kind of assets, you are doing great. Probably you're doing better now than you've done in the past 40 or 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
The stock market is going gangbusters. If you are a big player in that, you're doing really well. Those who have only their labor to sell are getting crushed.
Yeah.
Their wages are deteriorating. For non-college educated men in particular, it's the one group where their wages have actually declined over the period of the knowledge economy, the service mm-hmm. sector, you know? And when we understand that as an economic problem more than a moral problem, you start to see the fallout from this. Right now, a recent report from Moody's came out that said something like 50% of all consumption is done by the top 10% of earners, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's not an economy that can grow. Mm. It's not if you have such concentration, not just of wealth, but of income at the top, where they're the only drivers of demand, the economy will stay stagnant and it will stay sort of cloistered in these kind of regional bubbles where people have money to spend.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone else is just getting crushed and crushed and crushed and crushed. There's not enough decent middle wage jobs for these people to make a decent life.
Where do you see yourself in this larger lineage of the left?
Populism. I would say, social populism. Mm. You know, going back to the 30s, I think that the way in which the left has succeeded has been one that connects not only to the economic interests of working people, but also to their social values and social interests, and recognizing that working people's social lives matter just as much as their economic interests.
Mm.
The way in which I think the progressive, sort of soft populist progressive left gets things wrong is that they consistently see economic interests as a substitute for those sorts of social interests. So they'll say, we're going to give you all sorts of goodies from the state, but we're not going to listen to you when it comes to many of the issues that you profoundly care about, crime in your neighborhood, social disorder, these sorts of things. And there's a kind of attempt at making a bargain. And in a way, it comes off as extraordinarily elitist, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You have to understand that people's frustrations are of a piece. And if you make sense of them in those terms, that the social disorder and the disheveledness of our cities is connected directly to the economic inequality, to the lack of infrastructure spending, to the lack of these things, and make that critique as one critique, not as, don't worry about what's going on in the subways. Don't worry about the crime. Don't worry about the trash in the streets. Just vote for us because we're going to give another social program.
Hmm.
People will see that as neglecting many of their local issues, their local problems that they care very deeply about. You have to make these of a single piece. And I think that's where populism in the American tradition has always been the best. It's always been able to connect the local issues, the social close issues, to the extraordinary accumulation of wealth at the top, and showing that these things are related. They are not separate issues that can be easily disaggregated. They are of a piece, and the only way to tackle them is of a piece. You have to combine and appeal to local social problems with the global economic issues. People who are good at that win elections.
This is kind of the irony of this moment that I see kind of, I'll lay out a little bit of a lineage here, that an idea starts on the left, like reindustrialization, for example. And then the left is defeated and it rises as this hideous monstrosity, this weird reflection of itself from the right.
Right.
And then when you drop this into social media, into these like antagonistic identities where people define themselves in opposition to their opponent,
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden the left doesn't want that anymore.
Right.
And it was the left's idea a generation ago.
Yeah.
So this has been a real struggle because, you know, we are clearly in the middle of this like media ecosystem. And I've asked a few different people on previous episodes of like, are you part of an intellectual vanguard? Are you, you know, an activist class that is programming the movement's ideas from the top down? Or are you representative of the political will?
Right.
And in almost every case, people have said yes to both.
Mm-hmm.
And what I see emerging as the problem, trying to take a diagnosis, a holistic diagnosis of this media ecosystem, is that there is basically no representation of the popular will on left media.
Right.
It is all an activist class that speaks to an audience that is, it may seem quantitatively large, but it is actually very, very constrained when you get to the scale of a popular election. And a lot of its ideas are not well received by most people,
right,
unfortunately. So I guess the question is this a kind of runaway problem of media in general? That there may not be, based on the design of this attention economy, that this will be a little bit of a weird example. I promise it connects in a moment. But if you look at people's consumption habits for media, there's two important examples. One comes from pornography, where the extremes dominate, and people who have a particular niche interest will only consume from that niche. And so if you were to index the market of consumption of pornography, it is extremely at the fringes, and there's not like an even distribution of a bell curve of people who like what most people like, because people who like something really specific cater to the niche. It's the same for politics. That we're looking basically at a media question where people cater to the extremes of the attention economy. These are the weirdest examples I can bring up. The other example comes from the furry community, where there's some staggering statistic that 70% of people who are participants in the furry community have commissioned a custom piece of art, meaning that this very specific interest has a conversion rate that is like an order of magnitude larger than most other media models because it is so specific. So for example, just to make this very legible, if you were to have a popular Substack that's about tennis, one could reasonably expect that you would be able to monetize 7% of your following. In this very specific niche interest, you can multiply that by 10.
Wow.
And so we're seeing the same pattern play out in media where people who have really radical politics are willing to pay, are willing to fund. Right. Those things also run away in the attention economy. And so the representation of this thing is a very, very distorted mirror. And I guess the question is, one, how do you align not just the class interests of the people who participate in media, but two, how do you deal with the distorting effects of the media landscape as it's currently designed? And then three, hi everybody, this is Joshua Citarella. What you just heard is an excerpt from this week's bonus episode. If you want to hear more and get access to the full catalog for Doomscroll and other podcasts, you can support the show on Patreon or Substack, where I'm putting out new episodes every week. This is an independent show. I don't do any advertising, so your support is really what keeps this project going. Thanks for listening. See you again soon.